So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast, your weekly home for UK media news, recorded today at the London Podcast Studios. I'm Matt Deegan, and on the show today, it's Trump versus CNN again. What lessons did the broadcaster learn from the last election cycle? Also on the programme, Sony reduces its podcast spend and ITV revenues are down, but are they outliers in this advertising downturn? Plus, on the deep dive this week, we look at the perils of reporting on the Depp trials in both the UK and the US. All that, plus a media quiz on the best media quotes of the week. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, the Mirror phone hacking trial begins with allegations that Piers Morgan must have known about illegal activity at the paper. The trial continues, and we wish friend of the show Jim Waterson our best in these challenging times. Ahead of Eurovision in Liverpool, BBC exec Kate Phillips has said the primary concern is of a coordinated cyber attack. The UK is hosting the ceremony on behalf of Ukraine due to the ongoing war with Russia. And the US writers' strike continues apace with ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live, CBS's The Late Show and NBC's Tonight, as well as Late Night, all showing repeats. Disney Plus shows including Andor have paused production, as has the Amazon hit Good Omens. But today, live from the London Podcast Studio, I have two media experts here with me to cover some more stories shaking up the industry. First up, it's Deadline reporter and occasional Matt Deegan replacement, Jake Cantor. Jake.
Oh, apologies to the Media Podcast listeners. Yeah. No, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good, thanks. So, coronation, did you partake in any coronation coverage?
Well, I was watching for the whole day because, yeah, we were covering on Deadline. I mean, I was trying to keep an eye on as many different broadcasters as possible, which is quite difficult, but... I mainly stuck with the BBC. I think the big thing I took away from the BBC's coverage is that they totally ignored the protests.
Yes.
To the point where it wasn't mentioned at all. And this is not just
this
on
is outside of the news, a little bit this mentioned is,
yeah,
in the news.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, look, don't forget that BBC News was carrying the BBC Studios coverage. So if you were watching the BBC News channel, you were just getting what was on BBC One, which was basically no news. It was all coverage of the event itself. And I reflect on that, and I just don't think that's particularly a good look for the BBC when it preaches impartiality so loudly. And that has become a really big story about the coronation, and it wasn't even sniffed upon by the BBC presenters, while rivals like ITV mentioned it. Sky News even had an interview with a Republican representative, and smaller channels like Talk TV also gave it some coverage. And I just think the BBC looked a little out of step. I actually asked Charlotte Moore, the BBC's chief content officer, about it today. She was speaking at a Voice of the Viewer and Listener event, and her response was basically the news covered it, which is what you said. But I'm not sure That's a great answer when you've got basically acres of coverage without it being mentioned.
And also joining me from Edelman is Karen Robinson. Hello.
Hello.
And did you partake in the coronation coverage? Did you watch something different because you import from America?
Yes. As an American, it's always fascinating to me to watch the royal coverage. I did wind up watching it all day and from a slight critical distance. So I think we had dear, lovely friends who actually had travelled in from Kent to spend the day in the pouring rain, standing outside in a park, not seeing anything. And they felt very happy about their day. I sat inside in the warm, sipping tea and making snarky comments about it, which seemed about right to me.
And were you watching on the BBC or did you flick around?
I switched back and forth between the BBC and ITV. Mm. I actually basically watched the event itself on BBC and then flicked to ITV, which I thought had quite a good panel going. They had quite a good mix. But I think my highlight of the whole thing that summed up the entire experience for me of slight disconnection and kind of the sense that the media wasn't really reporting the truth as they knew it to be was the repeated times during the day when they kept telling us that it was only a light damp whilst the rain was actually coming into the, it was actually hitting the lens of the camera and there was wind blowing up. And I thought, you can be honest about the weather. Come on, it's
everything
fine.
Must be positive.
We're excited.
Okay, well, we start this week with a couple of stories from across the pond. First, CNN's decision to do a town hall with former President Donald Trump on Wednesday. Amid a barrage of outrageous comments, including calling the woman who he was convicted of sexually assaulting a whack job, host Caitlin Collins struggled to counter his worldview. Karen, what did you make of this?
Well, I think what I make of that is buckle your seatbelts, because we are in for a lot more of that between now and the next election. This was only the start. I think CNN took a lot of criticism for doing the town hall, and I can understand where that criticism is coming from. But I have some sympathy for the media, because ultimately he is the front runner for the Republican nomination for the president. He is a former president himself. In any rational world, those two things would make him a perfectly reasonable person to give some airtime to and let him put forward his policies and his goals for the United States. The problem is he doesn't have policies and goals for the United States. What he has is a sort of, you know, knee-jerk narcissism and a desire to lash out. I mean, I think you mentioned E. Jean Carroll. It was very gratifying to see that that she proved her case in court. She had the opportunity of doing that. It was found that Trump's team put up no defense to the charges against him. Effectively, no one testified on his behalf. She had quite a few people testifying on her. So it has been proven in the court of law appropriately. And a big part of that case was defamation, that he had defamed her by claiming that she was lying, and he proceeded to go right back out and defame her again, and will continue to do so. And if maybe a few years down the line there's another court case that tries him for defaming her again, then we'll see to that. But he just understands that he has the ability to do this, and there's really not much that you can do to stop him.
Well, there's no consequences to his lying. Yeah. And we've known this since 2016, but there's a danger that the same mistakes are going to happen again for news media being somewhat trapped. I mean, Jake, it reminded me a bit of the kind of Elon Musk BBC interview from a few weeks back. I mean, is there anything newsrooms can learn to better deal with these situations?
Try not to do interviews on the terms of their guests. I mean, that's a difficult thing to...
But even, I mean, that's even, a difficult thing. Even a one-on-one, yeah. Even a one-on-one with Caitlin... Yeah. Wouldn't have been that different. It wouldn't have had the cheers in the background.
Yeah, but I mean, look, they clearly had a very Republican audience, didn't they?
But it was for a primary, so yeah, it was potential primary voters.
So, I mean, look, when I was thinking about this, it feels like a bit of an overcorrection from CNN. I don't know. I mean, they've taken criticism for perhaps censoring the views of Donald Trump, or at least not giving him the coverage that he warrants. And perhaps being too left-wing. I think it's really interesting that this came like 2 days after David Zaslav, the chief executive of Warner Bros. Discovery, basically said, we want CNN to be a broader church and to reflect more views from all sides of the aisles. And I didn't expect to see it quite so soon, I have to admit.
I don't know if the people were surprised. I mean, this isn't going to be the last time that that there are events like this that news media have to cover. I mean, speaking of Musk, and we also learned this week that Tucker Carlson seems keen to waive his $20 million gardening leave to start a live show on Twitter. Karen, do you think this says anything about the new Twitter, where they're going to pivot to? Is it a pivot to video? It's a sort of old-fashioned term, but...
I don't think it says very much about Twitter. I think it potentially says a little bit about Tucker Carlson himself, who finds himself in a difficult spot now. I think it will be really interesting. I am not particularly optimistic about his chances of succeeding with that format, largely because the people who were enjoying, quote unquote, enjoying Tucker's racist ravings on Fox at the 8 p.m. slot are not the Twitter demographic necessarily. We're talking about typically older viewers, the core Fox demographic. So I don't know that there will be some, of course, but I don't know that they'll be flocking in high numbers. It's always worth remembering when you talk about the power of, quote unquote, a Tucker Carlson type person, that it's Fox News that has the power. It's them that put him in that slot. I don't think he has some cult of personality in his own right, but you have to remember that before there was Tucker Carlson, there was Bill O'Reilly, who was the man who previously had the same slot, who was a huge, powerful cultural figure at that time, who had the ability to kind of speak and make news, and who nobody's heard from since. So will Tucker Carlson go that route, or will the social media evolution give him more opportunity to keep his voice in the conversation? Probably somewhere in between, but I'm not that optimistic about Twitter being the right format for that.
And Jake, Twitter's advertisers have had a bit of a tough time with all of these changes. Some have pulled off the platform or paused use. It doesn't help Elon's aim to get more advertisers back on Twitter, does it?
Well, the perception is that those that are taking up Twitter Blue are of a certain worldview, and that may be a bit more right-wing, alt-right, I don't know, whatever you want to use, whatever term you want to use to describe it. And that's potentially the audience that Tucker Carlson is trying to tap into. I think the timing of it is really fascinating because, as you've just said, Karen, you know, other Fox News presenters have left Fox and just disappeared. I mean, Bill's a great example. Another one's like Glenn Beck, I guess. And the fact that he's getting out of the gates early and making sure that he there's not a huge gap between him being on Fox and then sort of reappearing somewhere else, I think is probably at the forefront of his mind. I think, you know, he's apparently, reportedly, according to Axios, taking a lawsuit out against Fox because of the non-compete clause. He's arguing that Fox News actually broke the contract and therefore it's null and void. But it suggests also to me that he may have some backing. It's not quite sure from whom. I think if he's going to take that risk that Fox come after him, then he must have some support from somewhere in order to show.
He's also massively wealthy.
Yes.
So he's done very well out of Fox. His wife is the heir to like a frozen food fortune. So actually the money is almost irrelevant. I think he needs to get back on the telly or similar digital platforms quick to keep his relevance up.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Twitter has a patchy record with video, doesn't it? I remember a BuzzFeed show, AM to DM, which has died with BuzzFeed.
Now, Sony Entertainment have downsized their narrative podcast team after a big spending drive that included the acquisition of production company Something Else. According to Bloomberg this week, the team was focusing on consolidating certain seasonal shows into single feeds in an effort to find guaranteed audiences for limited series. Get all that out. Karen, I guess this means more anthology shows. Does this strategy make sense to you? Is this just following what's happening in the podcast space, a bit of a pause?
I mean, it does seem to match what's happening in the broader podcast landscape generally. And I think what's happening is a little bit of, I mean, consolidation is the word you used, and I think that's exactly right. I think at Edelman, we often tell clients fewer, bigger, better. And I think that's exactly where podcast is going. It's there has been a proliferation of lots of things. They've been in this realm of let's try a lot of things on and see what fits. And now I think we've learned enough in the podcast universe to start to understand some types of program formats that do seem to work. And I think it makes, there's some strategic logic in putting more effort, more energy behind the fewer number of programs that we have confidence in. personally, I kind of regret that because I liked Podcast World when it was a little bit more open space and it was allowing a lot of creators to come to the fore who didn't otherwise have opportunities. That for me was one of the excitements about the podcast landscape. But I am not a media conglomerate. And if I were, I probably would see it very differently.
I mean, Jake, like Spotify, it sort of sounds like the big money podcast deals are all sort of being replaced with traditional, more traditional thinking.
Yeah. The giant pot of gold at the end of the podcast rainbow perhaps isn't.
I'm still looking for it.
Isn't quite there. Yeah, I mean, sadly, I mean, I guess you could do a story every week on media layoffs, couldn't you? This follows Spotify, as you say, pulling back on some of its original podcasts. NPR, I think.
Yes, they
very recently said that they were going to take money out of podcasting and put it back into radio. Interestingly, I've just, you know, as I said earlier, listening to Charlotte Moore, she was talking about it the opposite way around. So the BBC is taking money out of radio and putting it into podcasting. They've just announced this new series with Kirsty Young today, which sounds remarkably like Desert Island Discs.
Yes, maybe no great surprise. There are there are only a few core formats that everyone returns to. Yeah. Well, another media company in a little bit of trouble is ITV. They disclosed a drop in revenue of 10% since the start of the year. The broadcaster points to a challenging market with inflation and the cost of living crisis affecting their spending. I mean, Jake, ITV said their performance was still better than the wider TV industry. How so?
Well, I think ITV is very focused on ITVX at the moment, and I think they're pleased with the way that that has started. They're certainly talking it up to the market, which, of course, they would.
Double the views that maybe the old ITV player had?
Yeah, I mean, look.
I don't know what that means.
This is a low bar, I think.
Yeah, ITV, I mean, it should.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, ITV Hub was a not brilliant streaming service. I'm going to be diplomatic and choose my words carefully. I think that what we are seeing potentially with ITV is symptomatic of broader concerns in the advertising market. Other commercial broadcasters are also experiencing a slowdown in advertising revenue, and sooner or later that's going to start biting on content spend. And you talk to senior executives at broadcasters and they're all talking about conservatism with a small c rather than spending lots of cash at the moment. And that's not just commercial broadcasters, advertising funded broadcasters. That goes right across the whole gamut.
Karen, ITVX has launched into a pretty competitive space, but with Netflix taking ads, we've talked about it on the show, you know, consumers reducing the number of direct debit mandates, leaving their bank accounts. Actually, is the appeal of a free service become quite attractive for UK consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I can see the logic of it. Of course, in the UK, you have the challenge that the iPlayer exists, which is already a free, which is not a free service, but you know, it's paid for within the licensing. So I think, you know, the BBC is always very competitive there. But Netflix has slowed its growth. I mean, it's basically maxed out, I think, in a lot of markets. It's maxed out to its potential subscriber numbers, and they're seeing some small amounts of attrition. So I think there would be certainly opportunities for that. And I think ITV has, unlike Netflix, it has legacy content. It has a lot more kind of in the can to play with potentially. So I'll be interested to see where they go. But certainly, as Jake says, the previous incarnation was not a very compelling user experience. So I think they were smart to invest in making it work.
Stick around. There's more from Karen and Jake after this. Now onto the deep dive. You may remember journalist Nick Wallace from our chat last year when we discussed his decade-long investigation into the post office scandal. Well, now he's back with a new book covering the two trials of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, one from the UK in the midst of lockdown, where his coverage crowdfunded him, to the US, where he encountered a different legal system. Here's Nick.
It was a fascinating experience in terms of just contrasting what was essentially the same case being litigated again in an entirely different judicial system. In the UK, we had a single judge spending 3 months with the transcripts and the trial bundle to come to his decision. And in the US, we had a jury who took, I think, 2.5 working days to come to their decision with a very different set of information to work from and a, I'd say, significantly different method of delivering the testimony and evidence in open court. In America,
I mean, is it much more of a performance by everybody?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to come to that conclusion. And I'm sure there are lawyers and the jurors themselves would say, no, we looked at the evidence. But, I mean, there was one case where you had an expert witness who'd spent God knows how many hundreds of thousands of pounds or tens of thousands of dollars of their client's money on providing expert testimony in a report which had taken weeks to prepare. And they're not allowed to read from their reports in the witness box. They're allowed to refer to notes, but you're not allowed to read from your own evidence. So essentially they were being required to remember. And then the jury was being required to remember what they remember of the expert witness's memory when it comes to discussing it in the jury room. Now, one of the things I researched for my book is the really ridiculous amount of weight which is placed on our memories as useful tools for remembering factual events. I interviewed a memory expert who's unfortunately didn't make it into the final cut, but it was very useful contextually. I interviewed a professor of memory in the United States for the book, and his theory, and it's sort of borne out by the evidence, is that your memory is not a camera. It does not, even vivid events are not captured in a way that you capture them on film. The very process of recalling a memory actually changes it, and it gets stored back in your brain differently by the process of recalling it. Any other thing that is related to that event that happened that you come across or discuss at a later time will also change that memory of it. And there's a fascinating experiment about the 9/11 attacks where some fast-thinking person did a study of people a week after the event, a year after the event, and 5 years after the event. And of course, this is what they call a flashbulb memory, something that would obviously stick in the mind. You all know where you were if you were alive when 9/11 happened. And the study showed that 43% of the people they asked, despite all of them being absolutely vehement about where they were and what they were doing, their stories had changed over the three times that they went back and asked them. And memory is actually a way of providing our brains and our bodies with a survival guide for moving forwards through life. It's not a way of recording information. Yet the US, well, just US justice system appears to be much more focused on memory, the reliability of memory, what the jurors remember of what they saw in court, and the thing that's going to stick in their mind is a performance.
Yes, well, obviously it was covered in America on television, on court TV, very different to what we have in the UK, where it's rare for cameras to be in the court other than judgments now. And therefore, a lot of people were playing along at home and watching along. And I remember looking at some of your social media, people were very much either one team or the other.
There are millions of people invested in the outcome of this legal battle, and millions of people continue to endlessly hurl vitriol and abuse at each other online even now, because there are those who believe that Amber Heard was telling the truth and Johnny Depp used his money and influence to get the verdict that he wanted. And there are those that are saying, look, television showed her up for who she is, and the jury agreed. God bless the American judicial system and its transparency. And there are arguments for both.
Looking at some of those tweets, some of the American audience couldn't really understand your impartiality in the case.
Well, this feeds into the wider culture war in America. You're, as George Bush said, you're either with us or against us. And the polarized nature of debate in the United States is such that if you, you know, and I appreciate that everyone brings their own unconscious biases to any environment, and it's you have to try and strip out your presumptions as a reporter if you're trying to be objective and as neutral as possible. But in America, even an attempt like that is not seen as something in good faith. And I'm not blanketing tarring everyone with the same brush. Of course, there are great objective reporters out in America, and people trying to do the very best to do a good job representing all sides.
But basically, by not giving opinion, you are hiding something.
Exactly that. You're shady. You're shilling for someone, but you're just not declaring your hand. Now, that makes you less trustworthy than an enemy. Now, if you're my enemy, I know exactly where you're coming from, and I can deal with you. If you're playing this objective reporting neutrality game, how can I trust you? And that's obviously turns on its head the broadcast system that we have in this country. And I think the tradition that many reporters, even if they work for newspapers which have an agenda, there is still a certain sanctity of yeah, what was it? Opinions are two a penny, facts are sacred. I don't know the exact quote, but you know, I always feel that my job as a journalist should be to get to the bottom of what the facts of a story are. And then if you know enough about a story and you've stayed with it a long enough time, you then may be able to, using the BBC editorial policy phrase, your judgment about what direction a story is going. And with the post office story, for instance, I've just been covering it for so long that I have spilled over into opinion. And it's a very seductive thing, because if you nail your colours to a mast, or you say something which is, it does point to an opinion about a specific thing which carries with it your judgment, people start investing in you and your opinion. And it, you can see how on social media, like for instance during the pandemic, the pro-lockdowners and the anti-lockdowners, the more strident the opinions, the more of a following that they got, the more that they were lionized amongst their specific camps in social media. I mean, I get accused of being a journalistic shill. I'm not quite sure who for or what that would mean, but you know, the abuse,
or where the money comes from.
Yeah, well, this is the point. You know, if I wanted to make money out of my coverage of the Johnny Depp story, I would nail my colours to one particular mast and start hammering away. There's no money in trying to, as I've learned to my bitter experience, there is no money in trying to carve a neutral path. But I think it is, I think this sounds awful. Well, not awful, it's just pompous. I don't want to be like that sort of person. But I think it's important that someone is trying to do this.
Yes.
And I think the more people who try to do this, the better the world gets.
That was Nick Wallace speaking to me earlier. Depp versus Heard, The Unreal Story, is available from Wednesday. And you can check out a longer conversation about his time in the States reporting on the case and how to hold your own on social media against Team Depp and Team Amber when you join our Patreon. Just head to patreon.com/mediapod. Doesn't matter whether you're a media student or a high-flying exec, there's a tier for you. So that's patreon.com/mediapod. There's also a link in the show notes. Right, don't go anywhere. We'll be back with Jake and Karen after this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we're back with Jake and Karen. Time for some news in brief. So BBC staff in local radio are going to be on strike again soon. This is after union members voted this week. This comes amid more criticism of the handling of presenter redundancies, described to Private Eye by one employee as a clusterfuck. Nice. Jake, a little extreme perhaps, but this hasn't been the easiest of restructures, has it?
I'm not sure it is extreme. I mean, the strength of opinion that I hear from BBC insiders on this issue is that it's a mess, and there's no clear way out of it. I mean, they just sat down with ACAS, which has tried to broker some kind of civil negotiations that will end up in an agreement. That has failed.
And they seem to be getting somewhere, because they put off a strike, didn't they?
They averted a strike last week, which was timed to coincide with the local elections. So, you know, a win from the BBC's perspective. The concessions that the BBC offered is they've, I think, removing the risk of redundancy for 300 journalists, and they are introducing further guarantees for redeploying people, I think, as well. That's basically the offer that was on the table as part of these ACAS negotiations. And that was put to members of the National Union of Journalists, and they have voted in a consultative ballot to reject that. I think, really interestingly, the majority has decreased significantly. So last year, when there was a consultative ballot on this issue, 90% of members voted in favour of strike action or actions short of a strike, and this week it's been 55%. So the BBC has made progress here, but there is still outstanding issues. I spoke to someone today and I asked what's it going to take for the deadlock to be broken here, and their response was to scale back the content sharing. One of the big proposals on the table is the BBC is going to make local radio stations share loads and loads of content, thereby sort of reducing the impact of the localness, and put more money back into linear radio instead of these big digital plans that the BBC has.
I mean, it's very difficult. I'm kind of torn on this issue. Obviously, radio is something that I think a lot about. And they're not wrong to say that actually investment into local digital content is a good thing. You know, BBC local radio might have a 13, 15, 16% reach in certain areas. That's still a lot of people that aren't getting BBC content. Redeploying that in digital is probably not necessarily a bad thing. I think what's been interesting, and there's some really good writing by David Lloyd, who's the program director of Boom Radio, has a lot of experience in commercial radio, saying that if that's he sort of agrees, but at the same time, where has the investment in digital come from up to now? And why, if you go to BBC Local or BBC Local news site, is it not updated very much? And will this magically be fixed by redeploying 70 people? I mean, it's a challenge for all broadcasters moving to digital, but why are the BBC so slow on this, or haven't been able to grasp this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know the answer to it, but I do think it's, I always get my back up a little bit when people say we're going to replace broadcast with digital, because they reach different audiences at different times in different situations. So you have to think about who you're leaving behind as well as who you're welcoming in. And I think you need to do both, because obviously digital has a reach and an audience that can get to people who would never turn into broadcast radio, might not even own a device on which they would ever listen to a radio. But equally, especially for the BBC, as a public broadcaster, there are people who currently would not have access to some of the digital content that they're creating. For me, it's most important that we do the reporting, that there is still local coverage, that there is still local content being produced. But I would also like to, you know, in a perfect world, you would want that world to be distributed to all of the people who need to hear it. So a both and strategy would be ideal. That's clearly not where the BBC is at the moment. So yeah, there are some tough choices.
When I've spoken to people, Jake, I think one of the big bits of annoyance is how it's been done. Now, I've been on a few different sides of this in the past. I've been on the corporate side having to make some redundancies, and the aim is to do it quickly. It's not very nice, but at least you know where you are with it, both the staff that are staying and the staff that are going. And what it seems with this is it's been a really drawn out process, and I think some of the people that have been made redundant will now potentially stay on air for another 6 to 9 months because of how they're rolling out the localness. I mean, that's part of the reason staff are unhappy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been completely protracted. I mean, so protracted. I mean, as I said, we were talking about this last year. Look, the BBC will say it has to go through due process. But I think this probably shows how difficult the BBC finds it to make meaningful cuts. And this is an issue that the BBC is going to encounter more regularly going forward, not less. It's got to take money out of its content, unfortunately, and out of jobs, because it has a flat license fee and inflation is dramatically higher than its current level of license fee, of level of funding. And so tough decisions lie ahead. And I think it's been a little bit lost, actually. This is the first major strike action at the BBC in more than a decade. And I honestly believe it will be the precursor to further strikes, not just in the BBC's local divisions, but you know, more nationally as well.
Well, we've seen issues with the BBC singers, with the orchestras, with the BBC news channel changes, and some of this is about organisational problems, not necessarily entirely the cuts. The cuts are the reason, but how you deal with it is hugely important, and maybe that's where they need the investment to have staff who can do a better job of that. Okay, so we talked there about BBC News Channel. Jake, you wrote a story for Deadline this week about the new look BBC News Channel. So this is the merging of what was the BBC's domestic news channel that we see on the telly with the BBC World News Service, which people see outside of the UK. So what's been going on?
Yeah, well, that merger sort of officially took place on April the 3rd. So we've got about a month's worth of viewing data to sift through. And BBC News' audience here in the UK has dropped quite dramatically, 10%. They've lost 1 million viewers. That's audience reach rather than individuals. And viewers are complaining that they're not seeing enough UK news, that the agenda is really international in focus. And that's putting people off, quite frankly. Insiders will tell you that this was entirely predictable.
Isn't there also just a bit that those news channel ratings do flux?
I think that's true. The BBC, that's the BBC's response.
Right, okay.
They say that, you know, it's cyclical and big stories that will go up and down and all this. And they talked about a sort of wider downward drift in news viewing. I'm not quite sure that stacks up completely. I mean, you look at GB News, they had a jump in audience in April. Maybe they benefited from BBC News viewers deserting the BBC. So, there's clearly a bit of a downward drift, but some of the BBC's rivals could certainly benefit here, I think, from this decision. And the BBC's tried to dress it up as a big digital strategy, you know, trying to engage the TikTok generation in BBC News. What it really is a cost-cutting initiative. And there are lots of presenters at BBC who are sitting around twiddling their thumbs at the moment because they don't have any clarity on their future.
Well, it's a repeated story, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Karen, did you see this piece about by a former BBC journalist about the Brexit bus?
The 350 million.
Yes.
Yeah. So the accusation here is that Robbie Gibbs, who was at the BBC at the time, and then I think left to work for Theresa May. Mm-hmm. So
and is now back as a board director.
Exactly. So an interesting journey that he's been on. that he discouraged strongly the journalists from interrogating and digging into the facts behind the 350 million claim. And this is not the first time that Gibbs has taken criticism directly from former BBC journalists. I think Lewis Goddall said something on the news agents about it quite pointedly about, you know, having been taken to task by Robbie Gibb for not being impartial when he was sitting there thinking, well, but you yourself
we're not particularly impartial.
Are not particularly impartial. So it's kind of just more fuel for the fire. And I think on the back of the row about the chairman recently, it's just there's a tinge. There's a certain whiff coming up from certain sectors within the BBC's leadership, which is a shame. We're not finding the way out of it into anything that would look like genuinely impartial news.
I mean, this is part of Rob Burl's new book. I mean, Robbie Gibb, he's always been a bit of a lightning rod. And now that the BBC chairman has been dispatched, do you think the limelight might shine further on him and his ways?
He's an incredibly divisive figure in the BBC newsroom. He is well regarded in some corners, but a lot of people do not appreciate him sticking his nose into sort of day-to-day editorial matters. He has apparently, reportedly, ruled himself out of the running for BBC chairman, which I'm sure will come as a relief to some journalists at the BBC.
Probably an understanding that he is a lightning rod and probably wouldn't have the chance.
I mean, look, in an environment where we've had so much scrutiny of Richard Sharpe's sort of political connections, to install Robbie Gibb would be a hugely provocative move, I think. But, you know, his argument is, I'm just doing my job. I'm trying to hold the BBC's feet to the flames on impartiality. I'm trying to make sure that we dispel or break down some of the groupthink. This is a word that the Conservatives love within the BBC. And, you know, I'm perfectly entitled to do that. That's his position.
I just think it's really interesting because this impartiality word gets used so much, as you say, by typically by one side of the political spectrum to criticise the BBC. And I think it's a shame because actually it's an interesting and it's an important word. It's an important principle to try and adhere to. And I don't think any one person should ever be trusted to decide what counts as impartial, right? So what we need is a little bit more of a holistic view of a range of a plurality of viewpoints. You need to have the discipline. I mean, there's a whole set of cultures and institutions that go behind impartiality. And I would like to see the Robbie Gibbses of the world actually embrace that as something that, you know, needs to be achieved collectively and not by one person's point of view being rammed down the throat of the organization. But that's just me.
Well, Deborah Turnis this week has talked about BBC Verify, which is a sort of an idea to try and be a bit more transparent about news sources. I think she did this at a media conference this week. I mean, it's the right idea, but it's tough to achieve, isn't it?
Well, I think there's a long-standing problem, isn't there, of access journalism and the difficulty of, you know, in order to cultivate your sources, journalists have to do certain, you know, have to have certain relationships and conversations. And I know in the American media, it's often reported that, you know, a reporter, especially doing a political beat, will run a couple of profile pieces to get themselves access that they can then use. And their argument would always be, when the times get tough, I was about to use a different word, and they've got a real story that they need to dig into, they've got that to pull on. I think you know, the transparency is nice, but still journalists need to have anonymous sourcing for a lot of things or you don't get big stories breaking. And a lot of the most important stories that we do find don't initially come from a place where the journalist could or should reveal who their sources are.
Jake, should we have a transparency report next door your deadline articles?
I mean, look, I'm sure she's not talking about journalists revealing their sources, but I really love the idea of BBC journalists showing their workings a bit. And I tell you who's brilliant at this is Chris Mason. He pulls back the curtain just a little bit on the sort of mechanics of his reporting. And it's fascinating. And he does it in such an articulate and everyman way. You know, it's so accessible. You can understand it. And he's been doing bits in his office as well. I don't know if you've seen it on the news channel. I just think it's really, really great. And I think, I mean, look, maybe it's because I'm a journalist, I identify with that and I like to see it. But I also I do think that that sort of authenticity does resonate with viewers.
And we were talking with Nick earlier about kind of belief from the audience. And I think in this world where everyone's got their own filter bubbles, they are thinking about providers, be they journalists or people on the TV or people in print, about whether they're telling the truth or not and whether they're realistic. And sometimes being independent makes you seem like you're not being realistic or truthful. So drawing back the curtain, maybe rebuild some of that trust.
Yeah. I mean, I think I like the idea of doing it personally. I like the idea of putting the journalist first person into the story. I think that's also really great for trust building. We have a big problem with just sort of generally the media not being trusted. And I think when they report things in the sort of authorial voice of, you know, independence, you know, as if in passive voice, it doesn't necessarily help with all that. But there have been a lot of efforts to try and peel back the curtain on things that have been less successful. And I think one example that I always think about is the Washington Post and the New York Times, both in the US, they, when they had some kind of problems with sourcing, they then put out policies that said, if someone's going to be, for example, anonymous, you have to reveal why they've been anonymous. And now Washington Post and New York Times articles are filled with ridiculous statements like, so-and-so said, you know, using an anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss this. It's like, well,
really
how have you
much.
Informed anyone? It's not helpful. So I think Chris Mason is a really good example of doing it with some humanity and not ridiculous policies like that.
Well, talking about direct verification leads us on to the media quiz, which this week is entitled Don't Quote Me. Three comments from the week's media news. You tell me who said them or who said them about whom. Makes perfect sense. So buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Karen, you will say.
Karen.
And Jake, you will say.
Jake, right. I haven't done my homework for this. So.
Yeah, I don't feel prepped.
Prep for the quiz? Yeah. No such thing. Okay, question number one. Which celebrated TV writer said that streamers need more soaps?
Jake?
Yes.
Is this Stephen Knight?
It is Stephen Knight off of Peaky Blinders. and other things. Do you know the much more of the story?
No, I don't. I know. I caught the headline and I thought that seems like a smart thing to say potentially, and also probably angling for a good bit of business from from a streaming network. Although not that Stephen Knight needs it particularly.
Well, Neighbours is moving to Amazon.
Yes.
So maybe they've got their own soap opera. Do you think streaming television is the right place for soap operas? There's a lot of soapy stuff. I've just been watching whatever the Madam Secretary ripoff's called, and that's basically a soap opera, and Scandal and things like that is quite soapy, isn't it?
No, I'm currently enjoying the Bridgerton spin-off.
Yes.
Dishy, I enjoy it. so yeah, it's interesting. I really like the thought that they should have more soaps, but I think it's interesting because a lot of the kind of tropes of soap operas are designed to keep broadcast viewers tuning in for the next day. Mm. So, you know, the classic, you know, the EastEnders, when the music kicks up, you know what they're doing. They're saying, stay with us. But actually, I think in some ways you could argue it works even better for binging because, you know, Netflix made its fortune to date on keeping people going for the next episode and the next. They've done that by keeping things kind of flowing through. So it almost felt like there were no interstitial episodes. But I like the idea of keeping it really soapy.
The binge thing is always one more episode.
I
know it's 1:05, but just one more episode.
But the idea of doing a soap suggests that you might do it on a sort of daily basis.
Mm. Yeah.
And then, but the thing about soaps for the traditional broadcasts is that they are foundational and they bring viewers in and allow them to access other parts of the schedule. Mm. So if a streamer did that, you could plug other content potentially. I don't know.
There isn't a lot of cross promotion within shows. I mean, Apple TV do a bit of it. We don't really see it so much on Netflix. It'll be interesting to see what they do. Right, question number two. Who has requested that GB News attends a meeting to discuss its approach to compliance?
Jake.
Yes, Jake.
This is Ofcom.
It is Ofcom. Yeah. This is for GB News' second significant breach.
Yeah.
And this was the Naomi Wolf interview, wasn't it?
It was.
Where Naomi Wolf was allowed to go on for an extended period of time spreading COVID misinformation and suggesting that vaccines were dangerous and killing millions of people. And I think it was quite interesting because, you know, the Ofcom was saying, look, we accept that there need to be a variety of views, but also it has to be responsible and you have to consider viewer safety, which seems a reasonable point to make when you're talking about something as potentially deadly as vaccine denialism.
I mean, Jake, it sounds quite minor being invited into a meeting with Ofcom, but actually on the kind of pantheon of them being annoyed, disappointed, a meeting's actually quite high on the list.
A bit miffed.
And probably a bit before the old fining.
Yeah, I mean, this registers in the red for Ofcom. I think if you don't know the way that Ofcom operates, then you'll look at this and think, a meeting? Which is, to be fair, I had that response as well. I think this is really serious. They've said that these are two significant breaches. And I imagine that meeting will involve some sort of final warning. And if it happens again, there will be some sanctions, I should imagine.
Well, GB News has lost £30 million last year, so they can't afford a fine from Ofcom too. Right, question number three. Who was Naga Manchetti referring to when she tweeted this week, "What a loss"? Anyone?
I don't know this.
So, no idea.
So this is BBC presenter Razia Iqbal. She said on Twitter, "Personal news, after more than 3 decades, my career at the BBC is drawing to a close. I leave in the summer and I'm so grateful for the brilliance of colleagues, the trust people put in us to tell their stories and transformative adventures. New horizons beckon." She was a BBC news presenter. I mean, there's going to be a lot more of these, aren't there? And it's sort of slightly difficult for colleagues who are stars to talk about it.
There has been a lot of them already. I mean, the BBC has suffered somewhat of an exodus, a real brain drain. You know, you only need to look at you mentioned Lewis Goodall earlier. You can
Emily
name
Maitlis.
Emily Maitlis and John Sopel and Andrew Marr and Andrew Neil, and the list goes on and on. And there's just going to be this steady drip, I think, of senior journalists leaving the BBC. And that can be for many reasons. Pay, potentially. People talking about finding their editorial voice because they've been straitjacketed by the BBC's very strict impartiality rules. You know, there are lots of reasons why people might want to get out and try some commercial clothes on, potentially.
Well, congratulations, Jake. You win the media quiz. And as part of the prize, you get to review of impartiality across all news networks. Congratulations. Do come back with your report. Thank you both for today. Karen, where can people keep up with what you're up to?
Well, as long as it's still up, I'm still on Twitter. So at KarenJR, K-A-R-I-N-J-R on Twitter, and follow me there.
Lovely. And Jake?
Yeah, at Jake_Cantor.
And of course, they can read your excellent work in Deadline.
Yes, or not excellent work as well.
thanks both. Thanks so much for joining us today. We've been recording at the very fancy, but affordably priced, the London Podcast Studios in central London with a full HD fixed rig and a smile at the door. We highly recommend them. Book your next recording here. Just go to thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's thelondonpodcaststudios.com. There's a link in the show notes. And to hear more from Nick Wallace and how he's managed to sustain his investigations through donations, you just need to join our Patreon, where the fun never stops. There's several hours of insight to access, including all of Nick's work. Just head to patreon.com/mediapod, patreon.com/mediapod. And remember, you can now watch a lot of this on YouTube as well. So maybe you can mention that to your colleagues when you talk about us on Twitter or LinkedIn. And all new episodes, as well as being on YouTube, are on in your podcast app of choice. Subscribe at podfollow.com/themediapodcast. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer is Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.